from Pacifica. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from Miami with acclaimed Chilean novelist Isabel Allende.
History books are written by male authors, usually white, and so the people of color, the people who are defeated, the indigenous people, women, children, never existed. The world was populated only by males, by the winners.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez in New York with Pulitzer Prize winning author Alice Walker.
We are the ones we have been waiting for. And we're the ones we've been waiting for because we live in a time of global enlightenment and we can do more things and see more things than our ancestors could ever dream of seeing and doing.
Alice Walker and Isabel Allende, two women, two books, many worlds. All that and more coming up. But first, let's go back to Miami, to Amy, for today's top headlines. Amy?
Thanks, Juan. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A U.S. soldier has been sentenced to 90 years in prison for his role in the rape of an Iraqi girl and the killing of her and her family last March. The soldier, Specialist James Barker, was sentenced one day after pleading guilty and agreeing to testify against four other suspects. Barker has admitted he raped the girl, Abir Qasim Hamza al-Janabi, while her parents and five-year-old sister were herded into an adjoining room of their home and shot dead. Two other suspects, former soldier Stephen Green and Sergeant Paul Cortez, raped Abir before shooting her and burning her body in an effort to cover up their crime. At his hearing Thursday, Barker wept as he delivered a statement to the court. Barker said, quote, "I want the people of Iraq to know I did not go there to do the terrible things that I did. I do not ask anyone to forgive me today." Barker will be eligible for parole after 20 years. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the U.S. military says four American security contractors are being held hostage after their convoy came under attack by insurgents. The military also announced the deaths of four soldiers Thursday. This month's U.S. death toll has now reached 45. The New York Times is reporting U.S. airstrikes on Afghanistan are again on the rise. Defense officials say the Air Force has conducted more than 2,000 bombings since June. That's at least 20 times more than the number of airstrikes in Iraq over the same period. In Chile, the daughter of former dictator Augusto Pinochet has announced her father is willing to meet with the victims, families of victims tortured or disappeared under his rule.
He feels very pained by this, and he has told me that he feels if he would be able to meet these people, he would express to them a profound apology. And this is the truth because he has not announced this. He told me this in private.
The daughter, Lucia Pinochet, went on to say Pinochet is not willing to seek a national pardon. Her comments come 2 weeks after Pinochet was put under house arrest for overseeing kidnapping, murder, and torture at the state secret prison of Villa Grimaldi. Lorena Pizarro, president of the Relatives of the Detained and Disappeared group, dismissed the overture.
This is not important to us. We are not these poor little relatives that have gone through so much as I think Lucia Pinochet made out. I think that Pinochet must once and for all go to the tribunals to speak and to take responsibility for these crimes. We do not have anything to talk about with this dictator. What we want is that the dictator is condemned, judged and condemned for the crimes for which he is responsible.
Meanwhile, some leading human rights lawyers believe Pinochet's reported comments may undermine the former dictator's repeated defense to avoid being brought to court. Pinochet has served several charges in recent years, but has succeeded in having most dismissed on grounds he's mentally unfit to stand trial. The African Union has reached an agreement with Arab, European, and UN leaders for a joint peacekeeping mission with the European Union in Darfur. The planned force could include some 27,000 troops, including the existing 7,000-member African Union deployment. The Sudanese government took part in the deliberations but has not given its unqualified approval. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is calling for an international conference, including the Sudanese government and rebel groups, to resolve the outstanding issues by the end of the year. The agreement comes amid reports the pro-government Janjaweed militias have increased attacks on Darfurian civilians. On Thursday, Jan Egeland, the UN's top humanitarian official, spoke from Western Darfur.
We have a total meltdown for security now in West Darfur. I never would have believed it has gotten so bad in recent weeks. We hear story after story of armed men attacking defenseless women and children.
In Mexico, leaders of the popular uprising in the state of Oaxaca are lashing out at government claims their members were responsible for the fatal shooting of American journalist Brad Will. Will was shot and killed in Oaxaca 3 weeks ago today. His assailants have been identified as local police officers and government officials. These government officials are claiming, or government officials are claiming, that Brad Will was shot at close range by members of the Popular Assembly of Oaxacan People, or APO. On Thursday, APO spokesperson Florencio Lopez Martinez denied the charges and accused Oaxaca's governor and other officials of plotting the crime.
Ahora pretenden tender una cortina de humo variando
los... Now they want to put up a smokescreen to change the real facts about the case to involve even members of the APO, something we flatly reject. We think Ulises Ruiz, Eliodoro Diaz, and Manuel Martinez are responsible for the murder.
In Israel, a government cabinet minister is calling for an increase in the so-called targeted killing of Palestinian leaders. In an address on public radio Thursday, Infrastructure Minister Benjamin Ben-Eliezer said the attack should be broadened and that not even Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh should be immune. Here in the United States, Thursday was a day of victory and defeat for Democratic Congressmember Nancy Pelosi on Capitol Hill. In a historic move, Pelosi was chosen by acclamation to become the nation's first female House Speaker. But in a direct rebuke to her wishes, House Democrats also voted to make Congressmember Steny Hoyer of Maryland the new House Majority Leader. Pelosi had openly campaigned for Congressmember John Murtha of Pennsylvania. The final vote was 149-86. The session marked an end to a bitter leadership campaign that saw Murtha's opponents accusing him of corruption. In other news from Capitol Hill, the Senate approved legislation Thursday to begin nuclear cooperation with India. The measure received bipartisan support to pass 85-12. Dissenting Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota argued the agreement will increase nuclear proliferation and worsen tensions between India and Pakistan.
Any nuclear deal, any relationship we have with another country that deals with nuclear power and nuclear issues should be judged, in my opinion, on whether it reduces the number of nuclear weapons. Does it reduce the nuclear weapons that exist or increase them? It's quite clear that what we're debating today will result in an increase in nuclear weapons in India. I don't think there's much doubt about that. This bill fails that test, in my judgment.
In other news, a new government audit is warning the Bush administration's plan for a high-tech virtual border fence will likely cost far more than its initial $2 billion estimate. The virtual fence will utilize sensors, cameras, and drones to monitor the borders with Canada and Mexico. The Homeland Security Department's Inspector General now says the plan could cost up to $30 billion. Here in Florida, a journalist whose reporting led to the federal investigation into jailed University of South Florida professor Sami Alarian has admitted he's romantically involved with one of the case's lead prosecutors. The reporter, Michael Fechter of the Tampa Tribune, has been widely criticized for displaying bias in his coverage of Alarian and his alleged links to the Palestinian militant group Islamic Jihad. Alarian has been jailed for over 3 years, despite the fact the jury in his case failed to return a single guilty verdict on any of the charges brought against him. Fechter insists his relationship with the prosecutor, Sherry Krigsman, began after the end of Alarian's trial last year. Fechter says he stopped reporting on the case since the relationship began. The Miami Herald is reporting the Bush administration is planning construction of a massive new mini-city at Guantanamo Bay to hold military trials for prisoners. The $125 million compound would be the largest single construction expenditure since the prison opened 4 years ago. The administration wants to begin the military commissions by July of next year. Meanwhile, a recently freed prisoner from Guantanamo Bay has come forward with allegations of torture at the hands of the U.S. military. In an interview from his home in Turkey, the former prisoner, Murat Kurnaz, said he was beaten, given electric shocks, submerged in water, starved, and chained to a ceiling for days. He said he saw several people die and often thought he would die himself. Murat Kurnaz was held for 4 years before his release in August because of a lack of evidence against him. In California, a leading hospital chain has been charged with ridding itself of a homeless patient by dumping her in a crime-ridden neighborhood of Los Angeles. The hospital, Bellflower, is run by Kaiser Permanente, the largest HMO in the United States. Prosecutors say the case marks the first time a U.S. hospital has been charged with hospital dumping despite its widespread practice. And finally, the Bush administration is coming under criticism for its new choice to head family planning programs at the Department of Health and Human Services. The appointee, Eric Kerouac, is former head of a Woman's Concern, a medical organization that discourages handing contraceptives to women. The Washington Post reports the group supports sexual abstinence until marriage, opposes contraception, and does not distribute information promoting birth control at its 6 centers in eastern Massachusetts. Kerouac will play an advisory role on reproductive health and adolescent pregnancy and oversee $283 million in annual family planning grants. Cecile Richards, president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, said, quote, Kerouac's appointment is striking proof that the Bush administration remains dramatically out of step with the nation's priorities. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in Miami. We'll be back with Juan Gonzalez in New York in a minute. Stay with us.
We are the ones we've been waiting. We are the ones, we are the ones we've been waiting. We are the ones, we are the ones we've been waiting. We are the ones, we are the ones we've been waiting. We are the ones, we are the ones we've been waiting.
Welcome back to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez here in New York. Amy will join us from Miami in a moment. This song, We Are the Ones, by Sweet Honey and the Rock, inspired the title of the latest book by Alice Walker, We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For, Inner Light in a Time of Darkness. A renowned author, poet, and activist, Alice Walker is perhaps best known for her book, The Color Purple, for which she won the Pulitzer Prize in 1983. She was the first African-American woman to win the Pulitzer for fiction. The novel was adapted into an Oscar-nominated feature-length film and has been recently made into a Broadway musical. She has written many other best-selling books, including In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, Possessing the Secret of Joy, The Way Forward is with a Broken Heart. She joins me in the Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you so much.
Your new book is somewhat of a departure. It's largely essays publications of some of the speeches that you've given across the country, and what led you to decide to tackle, because you're always tackling major issues, but now you're also tackling a lot of the major social issues of our time in some of your writing.
Well, I wanted to publish some of the talks that I've given to yoga teachers and Buddhists across the country, and I wanted to offer a meditation at the end of each of these to help people get through this very difficult time and the times that are coming.
One of the things that impressed me in reading through the manuscript is you often refer back to the to your experiences on a farm and what your parents taught you about the land and farming and how that has infused a lot of how you look at the world.
I love the earth because I had parents who knew what to do with the earth and who respected it and could grow anything there on the farm. So I think that that's part of my spirituality. It just is me. It is how I came into the world, understanding how divine earth is.
Alice, it's great to be with you again. Although I'm in Miami now and you're in New York, yesterday we were together at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, where you gave an address. And you called your address, "While the World Burns." Can you talk about how that connects to your mother and how it connects to what's happening today?
Well, my mother was someone who worked very hard and used to watch the soaps. There was one called "While the World Turns." And I could see how this activity of watching these soaps in the evenings, even though she was very tired, gradually sucked away a lot of her energy. And I was thinking about how people like my mother could actually be a part of changing the world, even though they are so overburdened with work and children usually. And I was thinking that one way of doing that would be to form circles of people in your neighborhood, in your community, in your home even, so that during the really hard times, you would have your own mini community to help guide you through difficulties as the world burns and the world is burning.
Alice, just before the invasion on International Women's Day, you and a group of other writers went to Washington. You stood in front of the White House in Lafayette Park and you linked arms. And you write about this and "We're the Ones We've Been Waiting For." Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that experience, why you, Alice Walker, the artist, the Pulitzer Prize winning novelist, chose to get arrested that day?
It just seemed necessary because I don't believe in harming people. I don't believe in bombing children. I don't believe in making misery when it's totally unnecessary, and misery is not necessary. And so I was with other women who believe that the women and children of Iraq are just as dear as the women and children in our families, and that in fact we are one family. And so it would have felt to me as if we were going over to actually bomb ourselves.
In the in one of the essays, it was a really poignant reflection on a time when you were called to jury duty, and you found that the trial involved three youths who were charged with shooting a policeman, and mm-hmm. and you reflected on what the continuing oppression of African Americans has done to the entire community.
Yes, well, these three, actually these were, I think, two Asian men
right.
and a Latino,
right.
and they had robbed a steakhouse. And so when I was called to jury duty to see these young men, what struck me was how hungry they looked and how emaciated and how they just were children. And what was before them was life imprisonment, basically. And it just was horrible and horrifying and unjust and wrong. Because I think that this kind of punishment, even when children are adults who are really very young, do these things, we need to have a different approach than prison and interminable sentences.
But in the same essay, you connect it to a lot of the lessons that you have drawn from your studies of Buddhism. Could you connect them for our listeners and the audience who haven't yet had an opportunity to read the book?
Well, what comes to mind right away is the saint in Buddhism, Milarepa. Milarepa started out his life very well-to-do, but then they fell on hard times, his family, and he was mistreated, his mother was abused, and so he ended up murdering a whole village. And yet, at some point in his later life, in his development, he became one of the most venerated saints of Buddhism, which says to us that people change and they develop and they grow, and that if you just stick them in a cell and just leave them there, this is in no way going to make them into better people, and in no way will it ultimately protect us.
We're talking to Alice Walker, the Pulitzer Prize winning novelist, wrote among many other books, The Color Purple, and her new book, a series of essays based on lectures she's given, "We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For, Inner Light in a Time of Darkness." We'll come back to our conversation with Alice Walker, and then we'll turn to Isabel Allende, who's here in Miami at the Miami Festival of Books. Stay with us.
Sweet Honey in the Rock, singing Down by the Riverside here on Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez in New York. Amy is in Miami today. Later in the show, we will speak with Chilean novelist Isabel Allende. But right now, we go back to our conversation with author Alice Walker. And I'd like to ask you, as you well know, our nation's just gone through a national election, and there's been some kind of a change. And I'm wondering whether you have any hope that this will be a significant change in the direction of the country, or is it going to be more of the changing of the guard, but no real substantive change?
I think it's a good beginning, but you can see that people are awake and they're really awakening. But it is just a beginning, and the great fear is that people will fall back now and feel that they've actually accomplished something substantive, and that is not true. We have to really just understand that we're beginning. And I think if we know that, we can continue. And one of the things I wanted to mention was how important it is now, instead of rushing forward immediately, that we take some time to reflect on where we're actually going and what kind of society we want.
And as you go around the country, as you say in your book, you always had a fear of speaking. You've always wanted to prepare your speeches until recently now, when you went to, I think it was Korea. Mm-hmm. That's when you suddenly discovered that you had the capacity for just speaking without preparing your notes. And what is your sense of, when you go around other places in the world especially, how people regard what's going on in the United States?
I think they're very afraid. I think most of the planet is very afraid, because they feel that our leadership is actually endangering the planet, and I think they're right.
And in terms of the hope for the role of artists in helping to promote social change, you've always been very much of an advocate of the artists being socially involved. Mm-hmm. Do you sense among American writers and artists that there's more of a commitment in these days to using their work to raise the consciousness of the people rather than just arts for art's sake?
Well, I don't know many people who still believe in art for art's sake. You know, we have flowers for that. Most people that I know who are artists really are dedicated to trying to change people and to change minds and hearts. A lot of it has to do with just survival, that we as a species can survive and thrive. And so people are putting their hearts into their work in a way that I think they haven't done in a very long time.
Alice, you are a woman of many firsts. You're the first African-American woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. You are, with your ex-husband, the first couple to be, interracial couple, to be legally married in Mississippi. You're the first woman professor to teach a course in African-American writers at Wellesley University. Where do all these firsts come from?
They come from whatever is of interest to me. And so where my husband was concerned, I was very interested and loved him very much. I loved the writers that I taught at Wellesley. And I've forgotten the first thing that you said.
Well, talking about being winning the Pulitzer Prize in 1983, first African-American woman and teaching African-American women writers.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Pulitzer was a surprise to me because I didn't realize that there was a Pulitzer for fiction. But all of my work basically comes out of love.
I'd like to, Amy, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I wanted to follow up on one of the stories you told earlier, Alice, and that is when you were arrested in Washington, D.C., I was there, watched the whole thing go down. You were arrested, Terry Tempest Williams, Maxine Hong Kingston, Nina Utney, many other writers, well, it's a group of about 24, 25 of you. You write beautifully about it, and we are the ones we've been waiting for. But can you talk about what happened with the police officer who arrested you?
Well, the police officer who arrested me really didn't want to do it. And he told me, oh, my wife is just going to kill me if I come home and say that I've arrested you. So we started talking, and in fact, when I was let out of the holding cell, he helped me tie up my shoes because they make you untie your shoes. And while he was helping me tie my shoes, we started talking about his children. And so he wanted to know if I had written any children's books, and I had. And so I was able to send some books to his children. It was a very good experience because I realized that even though sometimes we think of the police as our enemy, they're really our family. And often, especially with African Americans, oftentimes it's the only job that many of the people can get. And so he was doing it very well, I thought.
Yeah, in your essays and in your newest book, you there's a lot about the earth and the environment, and but usually in Latino, African Americans, poor communities with so many other pressing issues that are confronting people, the social activists rarely deal with the broader question of what is happening to our earth and the environmental devastation. Your sense of the importance of people being aware of the need to protect the earth.
That comes from the way I was brought up. I was born and raised way in the country. We rarely saw other people. We saw more trees than people and more animals than people. And so I became very close to earth and to the knowledge that without a healthy environment, we cannot be healthy people.
Alice, would you be willing to read something from your latest book, We're the Ones We've Been Waiting For?
Yes. It is the worst of times, it is the best of times. Try as I might, I cannot find a more appropriate opening to this volume. It helps tremendously that these words have been spoken before, and thanks to Charles Dickens, written at the beginning of A Tale of Two Cities. Perhaps they have been spoken, written, thought an endless number of times throughout human history. It is the worst of times because it feels as though the very earth is being stolen from us, by us. The land and air poisoned, the water polluted, the animals disappeared, humans degraded and misguided. War is everywhere. It is the best of times because we have entered a period, if we can bring ourselves to pay attention, of great clarity as to cause and effect. A blessing when we consider how much suffering human beings have endured in previous millennia without a clue to its cause. Gods and goddesses were no doubt created to fill this gap. Because we can now see into every crevice of the globe, and because we are free to explore previously unexplored crevices in our own hearts and minds, it is inevitable that everything we have needed to comprehend in order to survive Everything we have needed to understand in the most basic of ways will be illuminated now. We have only to open our eyes and awaken to our predicament. We see that we are, alas, a huge part of our problem. However, we live in a time of global enlightenment. This alone should make us shout for joy.
Alice Walker, reading from her new book, We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For, Inner Light in a Time of Darkness. And before we formally introduce our next guest, Isabel Allende, I just wanted these two, it's hard to say California women, given that Isabel Allende is hardly someone we think of exactly from California, but to get a chance to greet each other. Welcome, Isabel.
Welcome, Alice. It's wonderful to hear your voice and to read your words. I think you are the person we've been waiting for many, many years.
Thank you so much. And we're together.
Well, Alice, thank you very much for having been with us. As we turn now to Chilean novelist Isabel Allende, we welcome you here in Miami.
Thank you.
Both of us are transplants for the hour. Isabel Allende here for the Miami Festival of Books. Chilean novelist Isabel Allende is a prolific writer with 15 books in just over two decades. Her works have been translated into more than 27 languages. They've hit bestseller lists around the world. Born in Lima, Peru in 1942, Isabel Allende traveled the world as the daughter of a prominent Chilean family. Her uncle was Chile's president, Salvador Allende. He died on another September 11th, 1973, when Augusto Pinochet seized power in a CIA-backed military coup. Afterwards, Isabel Allende's family fled to Venezuela, where she continued to work as a journalist. Her debut novel in 1982, House of the Spirits, chronicled four generations of a Chilean family through the tumult of that country's political history. It's a history that's intertwined with Allende's own. Her latest book is called Inés of My Soul. It recounts the story of Doña Inés Suárez, arguably the founding mother of Chile. Isabel Allende joins us in Miami. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It is wonderful to have you with us. I was wondering, as we just listened to Alice reading, if you might read a short section before we talk about the novel.
It is embarrassing to read after Alice. I will read the first paragraph. When I wrote this book, it was very easy to be Inés Suárez, to just put myself in her place and talk in first person. So this is her talking 500 years ago. I am Inés Suárez, a townswoman of the loyal city of Santiago de Nueva Extremadura in the Kingdom of Chile, writing in the year of our Lord, 1580. I'm not sure of the exact date of my birth, but according to my mother, I was born following the famine and deadly plague that ravaged Spain upon the death of Philip the Handsome. I do not believe that the death of the king provoked the plague, as people said as they watched the progress of the funeral cortege, which left the odor of bitter almonds floating in the air for days. But one never knows. Queen Juana, still young and beautiful, traveled across Castile for more than 2 years, carrying her husband's catafalque from one side of the country to the other, opening it from time to time to kiss her husband's lips, hoping that he would revive.
Isabel Allende reading the first paragraph of Inés of My Soul, her new book. She's traveling the country now. Talking about this work. Why don't you start off by saying why this woman, this Spanish conquistadora, as you say, why did you choose to spend the years of your life now writing about her?
I don't think I choose the character. Sometimes they just appear in my life. And Inés is one of those characters that history has forgotten. She's mentioned once or twice in the Chilean history books as a woman that accompanied, the only Spanish woman that accompanied 110 Spanish soldiers that conquered Chile. And the few things that they have to say about her are astounding. She was a dowser. She could find water where there was no water. Thanks to her, the troops were able to cross the desert of Atacama, the driest desert in the world, because she found water in every instance. She saved the city of Santiago from the first major attack of the Indians. And I'm not going to tell you how she did it, but she was there with 36 soldiers, and she saved the city. So this is a very extraordinary person who lived to be 73 years old, which was a long life at the time. And there are many things about her that I don't like, but those were very brutal times. And one has to see the life of Inés in its context. Today, of course, we have sympathy for the indigenous people that were massacred and for how the Spaniards invaded and occupied and destroyed civilizations in Latin America. However, that happened 500 years ago, and the clash of these two cultures was inevitable. And something happened after that, and we are the product of that time. I am a mestiza. I am the product of the Spaniards and the Mapuche Indians. So I can understand both currents, both traditions, and I feel that I can write about it because I feel it inside. I feel the landscape also. I close my eyes and I am in Chile, and I am in the Chile of 500 years ago before they destroyed the forest and they polluted the waters.
And Isabel Allende, greetings here from here in New York. And I'd like to ask you, in terms of your being able to unearth the facts of her life in order to be able to base your novel on it, how difficult was it in being able to uncover the trajectory of her life?
It was not that difficult because much is known about the time of the conquest, the place where it happened, and the 110 guys that came with her. So by researching all that, her figure emerged. And the rest was a work of intuition. I imagined the kind of person she would have been, a woman of Extremadura 500 years ago, probably not very tall because people were not very tall, but very healthy and very strong because she survived all kinds of ordeals and lived a long life. She was a passionate woman because she was capable of crossing the known world of the time for a man, her husband. And when she discovered that she was a widow, she turned around and fell madly in love with another man and went all the way to Chile following him. So she must have been a woman of great passion and great courage. She wasn't afraid of anything. And I can admire that.
I'd like to ask you on a more current situation. We had in the headlines the statement of General Pinochet's daughter that he will not apologize to the Chilean people for what happened under his rule. Your reaction when you hear that?
Long overdue. There has not been justice in Chile. Justice is very slow and not fair, blind, deaf. And the people who suffered during that time suffered in silence. Their suffering was never acknowledged. It was denied. Then we had democracy for many years, and the idea was that in order to protect this fragile, conditioned democracy, that suffering had to be put aside. Those people had to sacrifice their truth and their past and their losses. And so now it's too late, and Pinochet will never be arrested. He lives in perfect comfort and wealth, and I don't think that by apologizing to the people that he so awfully tortured and whose lives he destroyed, he will do any good.
We're talking to Isabel Allende. We're here in Miami. Juan is in New York. Here, Isabel Allende is at the Miami Festival of Books. She heads to Minneapolis tonight on a grueling book tour. But we're going to come back to her in just a minute.
Mi canto es un canto libre que se quiere regalar.
Mi canto es un canto libre.
A quien le su mano a quien quiera disparar.
Mi canto es un canto libre.
Mi canto es una
cadena. Mi canto es una cadena.
Mi canto es una cadena sin comienzo ni final. Y en cada eslabón se encuentra el canto.
Victor Jara singing Canto Libre here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. He also died, as Isabel Allende's uncle did, in those days after September 11, 1973. He, with thousands of others, was brought to the stadium in Santiago by the Pinochet forces and ultimately killed, the great folk singer. This is Democracy Now! Broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and NPR stations, low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on PBS TV stations and public access TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375 on Link TV. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. And our headlines are in Spanish and transcript and audio form for any radio station to take, as more than 70 are around the world. Yes, we are talking about global communications. We're talking about crossing borders. And we're doing it with Isabel Allende. I think there's no better personification of a woman of the world, breaking down those borders. Her book is Inez of My Soul. It is her latest book. It's a novel. On a current issue, following up on Juan, I wanted to ask you about Michelle Bachelet, your thoughts.
Yes.
And also the fact that this new woman president of Chile has just gone to Villa Grimaldi, where she had been held, as well as her mother.
Michelle Bachelet is an extraordinary person, no matter that she's a woman. It's wonderful that we have a woman president in Chile for the first time. And what is even more wonderful is that she has come to the government and appointed 50% of women in every level of government. So when you see a photograph of the secretaries of state or any official photograph, the caption says, count the women, because 50% are women. It's the first time in history that female energy and male energy in equal terms are running a country. It's the management of the country with this female energy. And I think that it's an extraordinary experiment. And if it works, it will be imitated and it will open up new spaces for peace and understanding in the world. Now, Michelle's story is very interesting. She was the daughter of a general. General Bachelet, who did not comply with the coup, the day of the military coup, and he was arrested by his peers, and he died in torture, tortured by his friends. And then his wife and his daughter, who was then practically a child, were also arrested, and they were tortured. Eventually, they were set free, and they ended up in first in Australia, then in Germany, where Michelle became a doctor, a pediatrician. And as soon as she could, she returned to Chile, even in times of Pinochet, and started working to defeat Pinochet. Then she became Minister of Health, Minister of Defense, the first woman Minister of Defense, who had to deal with the same people who had killed her father and tortured her and her mother. And this woman lived in a building where she would meet her torturer in the elevator. So this is what Chile has had to put up with. So when General Pinochet, after 30-something years, says that he's willing to meet the people, the victims, it's not enough. It's not enough. Now, Michelle has never talked about revenge. She has never talked about these things. She doesn't want to be used as an example. And she doesn't talk about reconciliation, because that is a word that she thinks is very personal. You reconcile and you forgive in the deepest of your heart. And you cannot ask that from anyone. She talks about reuniting, the Chilean family, getting together and building the future together. But reconciliation, forgiveness, is something that is very personal. So I have great admiration for this woman.
We're here in Miami, not that far from here, just outside Atlanta this weekend, will be a massive protest at what was known as the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. There are thousands who will be going there. You are the niece of Salvador Allende, who died on September 11, 1973, in the palace. Can you talk about the U.S. role, since that's what coming up this weekend people will be talking about, especially in Latin America?
The role of the United States, not only in Latin America, but in many other places in the world, is unknown by many people in the United States. People here don't know what the CIA and the American government has done abroad. And we know, because we are the ones who suffered it. The CIA was deeply involved in the military coup in Chile, deeply involved in torture and killings, in disappearing people. And of course, when Allende was elected, he was a socialist and a Marxist, democratically elected in the most solid and longest democracy in Latin America, Chile. And immediately, the American government decided that that could not happen, and they were willing to destroy anything in Chile to destroy Allende. And they did, eventually. So my role when I speak in public, when I go around this country, when I write, when I answer interviews, is tell people, because people don't know what's happening. People don't know what's happening in Iraq. We see stuff on TV that doesn't look real. It looks like a video game. We don't see the collateral damage. And the collateral damage are women and children. It's you and me. That's the collateral damage. Before, in a war, 90% of the casualties would be the military, maybe 10% the civilians. Today is the other way around. 10% are the military, and the rest are collateral damage. Civilians, we, the children, the women. So I get very angry with this theme, and I'm sorry that I can't keep my voice cool as I should. But I get very angry when I see what's happening. And I am an American citizen. I love this country, and I want to change it. And this is what I think we are doing, many, many people, like Alice Walker and many others.
Isabel Allende, I'd like to ask you, getting back to a remark you made a few minutes ago about the changes in Chile and the genuine feminization of the infrastructure of the government. Have you noticed the impact of that? In other words, in terms of types of policies that have been adopted that might not have been adopted in prior governments or even in other countries by overwhelmingly male leaderships?
Michelle Bachelet has been accused of being weak because her style is different from the male style. But to give you an example of something that has changed, 64% of the national budget goes to social programs. Can you imagine what the United States would be like if 64% of our budget would be for social programs?
We're talking to Michelle Bachelet. We're talking to Isabel Allende about Michelle Bachelet, about current politics from Chile to Iraq, and also about very old history, because Isabel has just written the book, Inez of My Soul. Can you talk about what the conquest was about? You talk about the blend in your own blood of or your own native roots. What happened to the Mapuche native, the Indians of Chile?
The conquest was a horrible event for the people who were in Latin America. There were some cultures like the Aztecs in the north, in what is today Mexico, that were very brutal and very cruel. The Incas were not like the Aztecs. And then the Mapuche people were tribal people who lived in the south of Chile, from the Rio Biobío south. And they were people who had, they were warriors also, and they had come to that place also by doing war against the tribes that were there before. But they were not brutal. They didn't use torture. They were nomadic. They only had what they could carry with them. They had a great respect and love for nature and the earth. God was the Mother Earth. And they wouldn't bother Mother Earth praying every day and bothering her with that, only once every 4 years. They left no monuments, no palaces, no temples, no ruins of cities. The only thing they had as a form of art was language, a language that was not written, an oral language, the Mapudungu. And this language was a flowy language that changed with the mood and the seasons and the events. And it's poetic language. So Chile is a kind of a country of poets because of that tradition. And then the Spaniards come, and they come in armors with dogs and with horses and with weapons that they had never seen before. And they never were able to defeat the Mapuches. They fought them forever. They never surrendered. And 300 years later, there was a sort of agreement to pacify them. And there is this sort of agreement with them. But they are ready to get back in arms any moment. Now they are defending a river, and they are willing to go back to war for that. I respect them profoundly. I think they're extraordinary people. And there are 200,000, approximately, 200,000 pure Mapuche in Chile, still living in reservations in the south. But we all have some Mapuche blood. So even those who deny it, I think we all have some of it. And if we don't have the blood, we have the culture.
And in terms of how some of those natives who are living today might react to your novel, which, while at the same time unearthing a genuine powerful figure that has been forgotten, is still basically a novel based on someone who participated in that genocide.
When I wrote the novel, of course, it's written from the voice of Inés, the voice of the conquistadors, the voice of the Spaniards. However, there are certain parts in the book, several parts in the book, in which I talk from the culture of the Mapuche. And I tried very hard to be faithful to their ideology, the way they see the world, the nature, the way they lived. And I have the greatest admiration, and I think this is very well reflected in the book, for Lautaro, the greatest general that you can possibly imagine. He can be compared to Napoleon in terms of course, given the circumstances. A young man that was able to create weapons, strategies of war, in order to defeat the Spaniards. An extraordinary, extraordinary man.
I'd like to ask you something I've always wondered about. You've lived in the United States for many years. As you say, you're an American citizen, and yet you still write in Spanish. And I'm wondering how that affects you, living in a milieu where everything around you is in English, yet your art is still being expressed in Spanish. So with the tension that occurs in the writing process, if any.
Well, I live in Spanish, and unfortunately, I live with a husband who thinks that he speaks Spanish. And that can be really dangerous for a writer, because I end up writing like Willie speaks. So then I have to clean up the mess. Also, my language has changed because of the English influence. I think that my sentences are shorter, my writing is more precise, more direct. I think better in many ways. And I like the idea of being bicultural. When I came to this country, I was willing to embrace everything that was good, fight against everything I thought was awful, and not lose what I brought with me, which is my language, my traditions, my way of living, hospitality, and many things that we Latins have.
Isabel, two things. One is that you were a journalist before you were a novelist, and I wanted to ask about that transition. And then another transition, and that is being an immigrant, not only into the United States, but all over, how many times your family has been uprooted. But start with journalist to novelist.
It was a When I was a journalist, I was a lousy journalist. So the transition to being a writer was easy because as a journalist, I lied all the time. I made up stories. I was never objective. So all that can be applied in literature, nobody notices it. On the other hand, I was a journalist in Chile, but when I went to Venezuela as a political refugee, I could not work as a journalist. So for many years, I did all kinds of other jobs. And I ended up writing because I couldn't be a journalist. I had all these stories inside that I needed to tell. And being uprooted and moving to other places has been my fate. I really was born in Peru because my parents were diplomats. Then my father abandoned my mother, and we ended up living with my grandfather in Chile. Then my mother married a diplomat, and we traveled all over with my stepfather. We had the military coup in Chile in 73, and I moved to Venezuela. It's very different when you move as a political refugee or an exile, because it's not out of choice. You are almost forced or expelled from the place you are. And you become paralyzed by nostalgia, always looking back, always wanting to go back. And then I became an immigrant in the United States, which is a totally different experience, because that you do by choice. And you look at the future and not at the past. And you really want to succeed, and you really want to make it. And I go back to Chile all the time, but this is my place. And it's clear for me. And that's very good. I feel empowered by that.
And do you have any words for government officials around the issue of immigration?
What shocks me about the issue of immigration is that globally, capital has no borders. Money goes wherever money wants to go. There are no borders, no laws, nothing for the capitalists. And yet for labor, for the workers, there are fences, electrified fences and bullets. I think that we should have international agreements for people to work and then go back to their places. Nobody wants to leave their village, their family, their children behind. Women who come to work in this country and leave 6 or 7 children behind and they don't see them for years and years. Those families are broken. You think that they do that by choice because that's the best thing? It's because they have no other alternative. So we have to have a more humane approach to that. And instead of building an electrified fence, let's do international agreements. We need that labor, otherwise they would not come. If there were not employers willing to employ them, they would not come. So why we penalize the poor and we do not penalize the employer? It makes me very angry, the whole issue of immigration. I think we should face it with a totally different approach. The globe, the planet, I remember that when the astronauts went to the moon for the first time and they looked back at the Earth and they saw this blue shining jewel, they couldn't see any borders there. They couldn't see anything. It was just a beautiful planet. Why? And we create the artificial borders. We create the conflict.
Isabel Allende, I want to thank you very much being with us. Isabel Allende's book, her latest, is Inez of My Soul, a novel. And that does it for our broadcast. On Saturday, tomorrow, I'll be here at the Miami Festival of Books at Miami-Dade College, as Isabel Allende was last night. On Sunday, I'll be at Busboys and Poets in Washington, D.C. on Saturday night at the CARE Conference, the Council of American-Islamic Relations. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Hope to Caduce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aaron Mate. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.